Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is audio from a webinar titled Trump's Presidency and the Prospects for Peace. The webinar took place on January 19, 2025, and was co-sponsored by the International Manifesto Group, Critical Theory Workshop, the International Action Center, the Palestine Chronicle, and Friends of Socialist China. The event's publicity blurb states, "Given that the U.S. is usually the prime instigator of our world's conflicts, and given that Trump sometimes spoke on the campaign trail about ending at least some of them, we ask what prospects the incoming Trump administration offers for peace. Will Trump's second term be more or less aggressive than his first? Will he honor his campaign promise to end the war in Ukraine? Will he double down on his enthusiastic support for Israeli genocide? Will he escalate the new Cold War on China or attempt another deal? Will opportunities for peace in Korea and Iran be seized or squandered? What to make of Trump's bellicose rhetoric in relation to Central America? How will the new administration affect humanity's trajectory toward peace and multipolarity?" Join us to explore all these questions and more. We'll start with Ramzi Baroud, editor of the Palestine Chronicle. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
Thank you very much for this introduction. Thank you to all of those who are participating and listening to us. I don't know how to describe this particular moment aside from extremely emotional, but also extremely revealing in terms of the nature of the fight that is ahead of us. I've been trying to articulate in my mind, how do we understand this moment as Palestinians, as particularly as people from Gaza? And I feel that the best way to put it is that, keeping in mind that the genocide is not of our own doing, and it would have been done regardless of the kind of Palestinian action or reaction to it, and it was already pre-made decision by the Netanyahu government and by the Biden administration. More importantly, actually, by the Biden administration, because it would have not been sustained or facilitated or justified or defended if it were not for the U.S. government. Considering all of this, and that we Palestinians had no control over how Americans conduct their foreign policy, how Israel conducts itself, it is the best possible conclusion. And I don't want to be misunderstood here. I'm not saying that the killing of potentially hundreds of thousands, according to Lancet Medical Journal, we're looking here at about 6% of the Gaza population, potentially up to 10%, if not even more. That is not a good conclusion. But the fact that we had no control over that moment, the fact that we persisted, resisted, we have created a new paradigm for resistance that should be studied, by everyone and applied differently to different environments. But we have discovered, thanks to Gaza, that we have space, we have margins to maneuver as oppressed people anywhere in the world, mainly in the global south, but even within struggles for equality and rights and liberation of various forms in the global north. We do have margins to struggle. And to prove that we have margins to struggle and to fight and to win, as Gaza has indeed won under these circumstances, a simple proof is that even before the genocide in Gaza, Gaza has been under a hermetic Israeli siege. I think this is very important for people to remember, because a lot of people, including friends and comrades of Palestine, might not fully understand the dynamics that preceded October 7, 2023. Gaza has been under an Israeli occupation since 1967. Gaza has been under a constant and relentless Israeli war starting in 2008. Gaza has been under a hermetic Israeli siege 2006-2007. Gaza had no freedom, no rights, nothing. Gazans were malnourished before the famine started. Gazans were unarmed and isolated before the war started and before October 7. So they did not start at a good advantage. They started, you know, as one of the poorest places on Earth, one of the most isolated, one of the most condensed in terms of population, and so forth and so on. So it started way behind, fighting not only against Israel, and again, this is important, but against the entire Western conglomerate. I know some Western countries tried to jump ship at one point. Many of them persisted, I mean, to their credits, supporting Israel and Zionism until the bitter end, even after the international community, the ICC, the ICJ designated Israel as potential entity that is carrying genocide and issued arrest warrants for Israeli leaders and all that. Still, they persisted until the very end. Canada is one of them, of course, the United States, Britain, among others. But that said, almost on the first or second day of the Israeli genocide in Gaza, you had five major world intelligence units operating from inside the so-called Gaza envelope, helping Israel gather information and conduct its war, genocidal war against the Palestinians. I think they were the US, Germany, Italy, Britain, and I think Canada is one of them. I'm not certain about that. But here you have it. Gaza is fighting against all Western major powers in all of their military equipments, in all of their intelligence. And lots of information also was revealed that Americans were on the ground, although the American government denied that. But we have some serious investigative journalism showing that Americans were, in fact, on the ground, including the particular massacre in Nusayrat, where they killed 271 Palestinians, wounded 800 and destroyed an entire neighborhood. And just for the record, that's my neighbor. That's where I lived. Everybody in it was killed or wounded to save the four Israelis, and the Americans were involved in it. Yet despite all of this, Israel has failed to achieve any of its objectives. No destruction of the resistance, no ethnic cleansing of Palestinians to the Sinai Desert, no dismantling of anything, no imposing permanent security control over Gaza. None has been achieved. Now they are trying to play with words and, no, we are going to keep some buffer zones and not buffer zones. They can say whatever they want to. They achieved absolutely nothing. At the beginning of the war, an ex-Israeli general or an Israeli general who served at one point in the Israeli army was in an interview with Channel 14, I believe. He was asked to define victory and defeat. He said, victory for the Palestinians would be a single child in Gaza City flashing the victory sign at the end of the war. We need to make sure that that doesn't happen. And indeed, they really did their best. I mean, they killed 16,000 children. They wounded a lot more. Thousands of them are still under the rubble. They did the best they could to prevent that moment. Now the entire Gaza are in the streets of Gaza flashing the victory sign. So even according to that psychological definition of the war, Palestinians have won. Moshe Viglin, a former contender for the Likud party membership, close ally with Netanyahu, turned against Netanyahu at one point, also said that what bothered him the most is that the fear factor, which is interesting, he didn't say Gazans or Palestinians, he said, Muslims are not afraid of us anymore. Muslims are not, and that was for him the real crisis. They needed to have that fear factor. You can't tell me that Palestinians right now, despite of everything, they are living in fear. So there are so many obstacles that have been broken, so many issues that have been sorted out, and Palestinians emerge with this new spirit of victory that is unprecedented. And when I say unprecedented, I say it from a historical point of view. I've been helping my daughter finalize her PhD on Palestinian history and the British Mandate, and one of the books I'm helping her translate from Arabic to English is a book by a historian named Akram Zaiter, one of our very, very early historians about 100 years ago. And he talks about the fight and the resistance, the armed resistance, but the popular resistance, the strikes in Palestine in the early 1920s, all the way until the end of the 1930s. And as I'm going through all of this text, I am searching for a moment, despite the proud history of Palestinian resilience and resistance and popular resistance, despite of all of this, I couldn't find from that moment until today, until this particular moment, few hours ago, a moment in our history in which we can actually claim an actual victory, an actual military and people's victory over Israel. The psychological impact of this are dire for Israel. And the psychological impact of this for the Palestinians is going to be generational and is going to be fundamental in changing the relationship between the Israeli occupation and Israeli apartheid and the Palestinian people, not just in Gaza, but everywhere else. This is the moment we are talking about. This is how history has been made. And again, back to the issue of margins, if Gaza has done this with no resources, virtually no resources, and during a state of famine, who is to say that oppressed people in far more privileged, and I'm not trying to undermine the struggle of any nation. I am based in the US right now, and I know the kind of struggles, and I know the socioeconomic disadvantages of many oppressed groups and many minorities and so forth. And I've traveled many parts of the world, from South America to China, and I know the kind of struggles that exist in other parts of the world. But considering that the hardship faced by the Palestinian people, that is something that is really even difficult to describe by words, I think other groups are in a much more privileged situation in order for them to actually sustain a long-term fight with very specific goals and ultimately win. And we need to take advantage of this. Yes, we need to talk about the victimization of the Palestinians. Israel has to be held accountable. International law has to apply. We need an era in which we change the relationship between the application of international law and the rest of the world, especially in the global south. Yes, we do need that, but we cannot take this from the Palestinian people. We cannot steal their moment of victory and glory, not just for the Palestinians' sake, but for the sake of all of us, because what happened in Gaza today means hope. When a small, isolated group of people win against the entire Western military conglomerate, anything is possible.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard from Ramzi Baroud, editor of the Palestine Chronicle. Next up is Jacqueline Lukman of Black Agenda Report and Lukman Nation.
Thank you so much for having me here on this panel. Again, my name is Jacqueline Lukman, and I am the vice chair of the Coordinating Committee for the Black Alliance for Peace. I am the host of Darker Than Blue, a radio show on WPFW-FM here in Washington, D.C., 89.3 on Pacifica Network, and all of those other things that Dr. Desai mentioned about me. And I want to start by saying that on the eve of the anniversary of the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, there's something else going on tomorrow that we're marking, and that's why we are here. And that is the inauguration of the next president of the imperialist states of America, and that is Donald Trump. Now, a lot of people are very angry and are very worried and afraid about the inauguration, about the Trump presidency generally, and particularly about the inauguration being on MLK Day. But I actually believe the convergence of dates this year for this inauguration is auspicious because it gives me the opportunity to raise the issues again that Dr. King raised in his Beyond Vietnam speech. And I want to first say that the entire title of the speech is actually Beyond Vietnam, Time to Break the Silence. That was delivered on April 4, 1967 at Riverside Baptist Church in New York City. Now, in this speech, King raised the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism plaguing this country in its society and impacting the world. And what King was alluding to is what we in the Black Alliance for Peace recognize as imperialism, which is why BAP was founded on April 4, 2017, to commemorate this pivotal address and as a means for us to pick up the mantle of Dr. King and raise the consciousness of the masses in this country to the issue of imperialism that he spoke of. And we exist to carry that cross, so to speak, that he bore. So many people today believe we are facing a second inauguration of Trump, and what many people fear will be increasing fascist repression against marginalized groups and expanding war because enough people didn't vote for Kamala Harris, because too many people voted for third parties or didn't vote at all in the recent presidential election. But we in BAP understand that we have arrived at this point because the American left has not been as successful as we need to have been in advancing King's anti-imperialist mantra. See, if we had, I believe there would be no confusion about the two wings of the bourgeois kleptocracy that we live in the United States under, represented by Democrats as well as Republicans, that advance the interest of the dictatorship of finance capital over the people. Currently, there is a grave challenge facing the left in the United States. We are confused about the nature of the Democrat Party, with many believing they truly are the lesser evil of the two major political parties in this country. Many delude themselves into believing in reformism and representational politics, in which small gains in limited areas are seen as major victories for the people, but the corporate bosses lose nothing. Actually, they gain more money whenever these reforms are passed, and no power is shifted in these reforms from those in power to the people. Or in the case of representational politics, in which voting for a person from a previously underrepresented group of people in power, like women or Blacks or Indigenous or immigrants, is a signal of a potential for political progress that never actually materializes for the people who have been compelled and very often bullied to vote for these folks in the name of progress. And those folks, the representational politics folks, are always, almost always Democrats. For example, when I talk about reforms, things like defund the police, which seemed like a good idea, and some city councils domestically claimed that they did it, but not one police department was actually defunded in any way. And in this country, while the political class used the demand against the very progressive forces that advanced it to quash further demands for any change at all. And if we look at this is the way politics has operated in the arena of funding of domestic military police forces, we expand that view to how we have engaged with the military budget, which impacts the rest of the world. And we see that the idea of reform is not effective, but it is something that is very popular within a Democrat context. But we also see the positioning of a Kamala Harris as the representation of better politics for marginalized people without any consideration for her track record on war and domestic repression against working class and poor people of color, ostensibly her community. But people do not understand, and when I say people, I mean people on the left in the US, seemed not to have a strong grasp on the fact that she is not of that community. So this is a class issue that the left in the United States is also very unclear on, because the confusion about the antagonistic nature of the Democrat Party to the working class and poor masses of racialized and marginalized people in this country and around the world, and the collaboration of the Democrat Party with the Republicans and their collusion with the elements of finance capital, this confusion about the nature of the Democrats on the left, I think was seen most sharply recently in the recent elections with the frenzied demands that supposed anti-imperialists made to everyone, but including other leftists, to vote for Kamala despite all of her existing evil and the evil she promised to continue to do were she to be elected. Remember, she said that her goal was to ensure that the US military, which is already the most lethal, deadly military in the world, will be the most lethal fighting force in the world. I don't know how you make an already deadly fighting force more deadly, but she promised that she would. And people were saying, people meaning leftists, some leftists here in the US were saying, we have to vote for Kamala Harris despite our problems with her to save us from Trump. This is confusion. But I don't want to dismiss the genuine fear of many of a Trump presidency and all of the evil, violent, racist, psychotic promises that he has been making to do harm to people for the good of the ideal of a white nationalist Christian America coming to bear on those people. I do believe conditions for all of us, working class, poor, queer, trans, immigrant, indigenous, African descended people, I do believe our conditions will become more harsh under Trump. However, I think it is important for us anti-imperialist leftists to make clear that the rise of Trump was facilitated not because of the lack of votes for the Democrat candidate, but because of the lack of commitment to advancing clear and consistent anti-imperialist positions to U.S. policy from both major political parties, its surrogates in the U.S. media, academia, and other bourgeois institutions. So the challenge facing the left under a Trump administration that is incoming is first, I think, admitting that the confusion on the left about Democrat support of imperialism is what got us here. Left support of imperialist warmongering against Russia, war rhetoric, the support from the left against some war rhetoric against China, and now, as we have seen, support of the imperialist U.S.-backed coup in Syria has obscured Dr. King's clear admonition of U.S. militarism and the money that goes to the war machine that destroys working class, poor, peasant people around the world, instead of that money going onto the plates of the same class of people here, creates the situation we're confronted with now, in which Trump is held up to the masses as a figure of singularly unique oppression, and some say fascism or proto-fascism or whichever term you would like to use. But had we confronted the policies from the Biden-Harris administration that have already created the same conditions that people are afraid Trump will create, I mean, Ramsey Baruch just told you that the Biden-Harris administration was involved in, deeply implicated, and completely responsible for enabling this horror in Gaza. If we had confronted uniformly with the same condemnation of the war in Ukraine, the war rhetoric against China, the coup in Syria, the attempted coup or invasion in Haiti, the sanctions on Cuba, the sanctions on Venezuela, the arrest warrant just issued by Biden for President Nicolas Maduro, the sanctions against Eritrea. And do you understand what I mean? If the U.S. left had been cohesively, loudly, and consistently condemning all and every U.S. imperialist policy coming from the beating heart of imperialism, regardless of who is the spokesperson for it, I am not saying that there would not be a Trump presidency. I do believe, though, that there would be more clarity on what this moment means and who is truly responsible for it. And I believe what that means is we would be in a better position to know who to fight and who we should be fighting with. Do you understand? Because I do believe that we are faced with an anti-imperialist left. Then, do you understand? Leftists who are inclined to agree with imperialist policies if they are justified by liberal or neoliberal logic of expediency, if that's what we want to call it, rather than, you know, the scary conservative logic of brute force white supremacist domination. What we're faced is a social imperialist left in which there is a labor aristocracy where the class interests of people in the United States, where we have more in common, the working class of all walks of life have more in common with each other, regardless of our ethnic, religious, racial, or cultural differences than we do with any of the politicians of any major or minor party or any of the corporate interests. And if we understood that and were consistent in working toward that, we would also understand that our interests are more in line with people of our class around the world, more than we have allegiance with those who have a D behind their name in the political arena here. We are faced with a labor aristocracy that has sold out the interests of the working class and poor people in this country to the bourgeois class, the finance capitalists, lending validity and legitimacy to the dictatorship of finance capitalists among the working class in this country, which undermines the struggle for anti-imperialism and the struggle to destroy this imperialist system in this country to save the rest of the world from it, from the entire kleptocratic imperialist system, not just from one person that the system creates. Do you understand? So in closing, I say that certainly this moment is frightening for many people, but it is not hopeless, because what we must do is stay true to clear and consistent anti-imperialist ideology and struggle along those lines for class solidarity among all groups of people, ensuring everyone's people-centered human rights against all imperialism. That is our task before us. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard from Jacqueline Lukman of Black Agenda Report and Lukman Nation. Next up is Gabriel Rockhill, founding director of the Critical Theory Workshop and professor of philosophy at Villanova University.
The comments that I have today are about fascism and the necessity of understanding it dialectically. So strap on your theoretical seatbelts. There's just going to be a little bit of methodological work to clarify what that means, because I think it helps us elucidate the current situation. The starting point for a dialectical approach is that we need to recognize that fascism isn't a thing in the world, but rather a concept developed in a particular situation to refer to an intricate set of processes of political management that appeared novel at the time. In fact, when the term fascism emerged in Italy, it was not at all a coherent doctrine or a fixed ideology, but rather a rough description of a dynamic and changing set of practices. Mussolini himself insisted on this multiple times. In its early phase, fascism in Italy was actually reformist and republican. It advocated for women's suffrage, supported some limited pro-labor reforms, feuded with the Catholic Church, and was not openly racist. All of this, of course, changed over time. A dialectical analysis of fascism accounts for these types of variations, but it is also thoroughly materialist, meaning that it sheds light on the ways in which these various practices are rooted in the socioeconomic base. This is important because fascism's specific ideological contours can vary significantly, even to the point of taking on apparently incompatible forms, because it mobilizes different religious, racial, or national characteristics in its project. It can be, for instance, white supremacist and German ultranationalist, as in the case of Nazi Germany. But it can also be animated by Jewish fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism in other contexts. Its consistency from a dialectical materialist point of view is to be found in its relationship to the socioeconomic base, not the ideological superstructure. Fascism is best understood as a form of capitalist social and political management that is more heavily relied on in times of crisis as, quote, the final solution to the class struggle, as Michael Parenti said. Fascism has been used to different degrees on various populations. Far from being incompatible with liberal democracy, I've elsewhere argued that it often functions in tandem with it. Consider the case that the United States, which maintains a bourgeois liberal democracy on the home front, nonetheless supports, and this is a quote from Victor Marchetti of the CIA, every dictator, military junta, oligarchy that existed in the Third World, end quote. The incoming Trump administration will not change the course of U.S. foreign policy in this regard. Having filled his administration with neoconservative war hawks, it is on course to pursue imperialist objectives in West Asia and intensify the hybrid war on China, as well as progressive states and movements around the world. This imperialist tactic is slightly different than the Democrats, who have been focused on the proxy war in the Ukraine against Russia. But the overall strategy of strengthening U.S.-led imperialism in a moment of decline is the same. It is certainly the case that the Trump administration has worked to present itself as if it were dedicated to global peace, when in fact it is above all devoted to pursuing imperialist hybrid wars while using some different tactics than the Democrats, in part to make it look like they are doing something fundamentally different. Regarding domestic policy, the United States has historically maintained a bourgeois democracy. But there is also, at the same time, a very powerful police state that makes constant war on the most oppressed and exploited members of the working class, particularly the immigrant population and racialized groups. Victims of this police state, such as George Jackson, have described it as fascist in its repression of the working class. And the U.S. has established, of course, the largest prison and detention system in the world, not to mention a global system of carceral black sites. In spite of some tactical disagreements, both Democrats and Republicans partake in what we might call imperial fascism around the world and police state fascism on the home front, while nonetheless maintaining a bourgeois liberal state. If we engage in a dialectical rather than a non-dialectical analysis, then we can identify these different processes of governance as part of an overall system. Liberal democracy manages the professional managerial class stratum and the upper layers of the working class, as well as acquiescent members of the domestic population. Fascism is unleashed on the non-acquiescent workers of the global South, as well as the racialized and potentially insurgent underclass on the home front. Rather than complete opposites, these modes of governance function as the good cop, liberalism, and bad cop, fascism, of capitalism. What a dialectical analysis allows us to see is that just like the notorious interrogation tactic, the good cop and the bad cop, as much as they would like us to believe that they have opposite agendas, are working together toward the same fundamental goal, namely the maintenance or expansion of capitalist social relations. Trump has been very explicit about intensifying the war on the most oppressed and exploited members of the working class, and this is the material objective behind his racism and misogyny. He seeks to escalate the war on the working class by targeting its lowest tiers in order to drive wages and living standards down for all workers. This is all packaged in an ultra-nationalist, religiously inflected ideology of scapegoating, a tactic taken directly out of the playbook of so many fascist demagogues. In a phase of imperialist decline, when it is materially obvious to most people that the United States is not as economically well off as it once was, the idea of making America great again plugs neatly into a logic of nationalist and religious rejuvenation via racist scapegoating. If it be against the racialized working class and particularly the immigrant population, or against the Chinese as the representatives of a systemic alternative to imperialism. This project has emboldened and empowered fascist organizations in the United States, like the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, and the Three Percenters. It has also been dedicated to dismantling democratic rights and increasingly making the bourgeois legal state into a gangster capitalist state run by robber barons. Indeed, Trump already worked with reactionary elements of the state and fascist militias, while backed, as always, by the most reactionary forces of finance capital to try and overturn the last election. He's also on record repeating that the 2024 election was the last one. What a dialectical analysis of fascism reveals is that it is a process of sociopolitical management that comes in many different degrees, and our analysis needs to be fine-grained enough that it is attentive to all of the dimensions of governance. It is true that there is not, at this point, an open fascist dictatorship in the United States, which is a very good thing. Anyone who is serious about practical politics should defend liberal rights and democratic rule over and against their fascist annihilation. What the incoming Trump administration represents, then, is an ongoing intensification of imperial and police state fascism, combined with an open war on democratic rights, a rolling back of the bourgeois rule of law, and an effort to embolden parastate fascist forces. When people claim that Trump has no ideology or is just an opportunist, they often accept, at least implicitly, the psychologizing descriptions of him promoted by public relations firms, which present him as an idiosyncratic outsider rather than a gangster capitalist with a very clear agenda. His discursive provocations, which sometimes appear erratic, are so constant that people should recognize them for what they are, a successful tactic for staying in the media limelight, regardless of whether or not he acts on them. If one examines his actions and not just his words, it is crystal clear that he has never been so erratic that he decided, out of the blue, to reject imperialism or embrace socialism. Moreover, opportunism, we should remember, is a dominant ideology under capitalism, and it has never been incompatible with fascism. If we see through the psychologizing public relations hoopla about Trump's idiosyncrasies, which endeavor to singularize him as a subject to such an extent that he's severed from the system that produced him, we can appreciate the fact that his ideology is actually on constant display and is absolutely consistent. He's pro-capitalist, pro-imperialist, anti-communist, racist, misogynist, ultra-nationalist demagogue. We are therefore at the dawn of what certainly looks like a very dark chapter of US politics, both at home and abroad. As it continues in fits and starts its imperial decline, its ruling class is desperately looking for strategies to rejuvenate its super profits of yesteryear and beat back the perennial threat of socialism posed most strongly by China. Capitalism in crisis is what is driving the growth of fascism in the United States and across the capitalist world. It is imperative to recognize it for what it is in order to take all of the necessary countermeasures. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard Gabriel Rockhill, founding director of the Critical Theory Workshop and professor of philosophy at Villanova University. Next up is Keith Bennett, China scholar and co-editor of the Friends of Socialist China website.
Meeting on the theme of Trump's presidency and the prospects for peace in 2025, it is natural that we look especially at the war raging in Ukraine for nearly 3 years and at the situation in West Asia as a tentative ceasefire emerges after more than 15 months of unrelenting genocide in Gaza. With so many thousands of lives being lost, is it self-indulgence or overreach to also turn our attention to the Asia-Pacific region? But today, no bilateral relationship in the world is more important, more strategic, and more fraught with dangers of global conflict than that between the United States and China. Faced with the peaceful rise of China, a rise unparalleled in human history, it has essentially become a consensus among the otherwise contending wings of the US ruling class that the preservation of US global hegemony necessitates taking China as Washington's principal adversary, from Greenland to the South Pacific, and from semiconductors to social media. As with Cold War I and the Soviet Union, the US seeks to reverse China's progress and bring it to heel through a combination of a debilitating arms race, ideological subversion, and economic and technological strangulation. A key difference is that not only has China drawn lessons from the collapse of the Soviet Union, whereas the USA and the USSR were essentially economically insulated from one another, China has spent the best part of half a century integrating itself into the global economy, creating such facts on the ground in the process as ever more complex global supply chains, and with China accounting for some 11% of US foreign trade. So what then does Trump's return mean for China-US relations? First, Trump revels in his role as disruptor in chief. So the first thing we should expect is the unexpected. Certainly, if he carries through on even a fraction of his recent threats regarding tariffs, not only will China face an economic challenge, the entire global economy, in a parlous enough state as it is, and not least the US economy itself, will be plunged into crisis. But overall, there seems little reason to anticipate a fundamental change of direction. When Biden assumed the presidency, many had hopes for a return to a more rational and constructive China policy in Washington. This did not materialize. Far from reversing Trump's anti-China measures, the Biden administration ratcheted them up substantially, especially in terms of trying to restrict China's access to computer chips and other advanced technology. And as Andrew just pointed out, Biden was the first US president, at least since the United States and China formally established diplomatic relations under Jimmy Carter, to state that the United States would fight in defense of Taiwan. So to the extent that there was change under Biden, it came essentially in two areas. His administration largely eschewed the openly racist rhetoric of Trump, Kung Flu, Chinese virus, etc., which undoubtedly made life somewhat more tolerable, at least, for many Chinese and other Asian and Pacific Islander Americans. And whereas Trump was an equal opportunities bully when it came to insulting and threatening allies and adversaries alike, Biden's team worked hard and with a considerable degree of success to reinforce cohesion in NATO, get the EU on side, and reinvigorate and reinforce old alliances, such as those with Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines, all with a view to confronting China, along with Russia, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, and other states in Washington's crosshairs. So, even if Trump ups the ante with China, it will not break the essential continuum established by Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton with their 2011 pivot to Asia. The team of rivals that Trump has been assembling for his administration certainly lacks the intellectual brilliance of that forged by Abraham Lincoln, but it is not monolithic on China. Trump himself cares little for liberal democracy, and on that level, at least, his antipathy to China probably lacks the deep ideological foundation that the US Democratic Party has come to increasingly embody. His motivation is more straightforwardly and overtly venal and mercenary. He will fight ruthlessly, but may be prepared to cut a deal if he feels the terms are good, or perhaps as importantly, if he can present it as a win. We need to think only of his apparent vault farce on TikTok, and just this afternoon he said that he intends to issue an executive order in that regard, is doubtless related to its ability to help feed his social media obsession. The same cannot be said for his proposed Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who clearly will not be satisfied with anything less than the overthrow of the Communist Party of China. A similar orientation could be seen on the part of a number of Trump's other nominees, including those to be given trade, defense, and national security portfolios. But this in turn is different from the stand of Trump's current bestie, although for how long is anyone's guess, Elon Musk, whose Shanghai factory accounts for half of Tesla's global production. Another area where this pattern can be expected to assert itself is in diplomacy, and hence on the international balance of forces. As mentioned, while the Biden administration strove with considerable success to unite the imperialist camp, in the case of Trump, from Angela Merkel to Justin Trudeau, if there's one thing he seems to enjoy more than insulting America's adversaries, it's insulting America's allies. The Asia-Pacific region is where key issues still unresolved from the 1940s continue to fester, and where the interests of nuclear powers, principally the United States, China, Russia, and the DPRK, collide and at times coincide. How will Trump in his second presidential term react to tensions in the Taiwan Straits or the South China Sea? On the Korean Peninsula, will he once again resort to threats of unleashing fire and fury, as he did in the early stage of his first presidential term? Or will he seek a further meeting with Kim Jong-un? No other serving US president ever dared to meet the top leader of the DPRK, something that Trump did three times, even accepting Kim Jong-un's invitation to step into the DPRK itself. Even after negotiations broke down, the two men are understood to have continued private correspondence. On the campaign trail, Trump spoke of his relationship with Kim Jong-un and of his desire to get back to dialogue. But the DPRK is not the same country as in Trump's first term. Its nuclear weapons program, along with its delivery mechanisms, is considerably further advanced, and its international position apparently strengthened by its new strategic alliance with Russia. On the other hand, the DPRK appears, at least for now, to have tired of the volatile, unpredictable, and unreliable diplomacy of the USA, which had stymied and frustrated some three decades of DPRK efforts to normalize relations. Regarding China, as Inauguration Day tomorrow looms, Trump appears to be playing the same game of personalized diplomacy. An invitation to President Xi Jinping will see the unprecedented attendance of Vice President Han Cheng at tomorrow's ceremony. Commenting on his phone call with President Xi on Friday, Trump said it was a very good one for both China and the USA. It is my expectation that we will solve many problems together and starting immediately. President Xi and I will do everything possible to make the world more peaceful and safe. According to China's Xinhua News Agency, Trump thanked Xi for his congratulations, saying that he cherishes his great relationship with Xi, hopes to continue to maintain dialogue and communication, and looks forward to meeting Xi at an early date. The United States and China are the most important countries in the world today, and they should maintain long-lasting friendship and work together to safeguard global peace. Of course, Trump never seems to have a phone call with another world leader that he doesn't seem to think has gone great. And just the day before, the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson slammed comments by Marco Rubio as unwarranted attacks after the senator in his confirmation hearing called China the most dangerous near-peer adversary the US has ever faced. But significantly, there has been no repetition of Trump's December 2016 pre-inauguration phone call with the secessionist leader of China's Taiwan province, although there will be quite senior Taiwan representation from both the ruling DPP and the opposition Kuomintang at tomorrow's inauguration. And last night, describing it as an exclusive, the Wall Street Journal reported that Trump had told his advisors that he wants to visit China within his first 100 days in office. Perhaps significantly, the Xinhua news agency was quick to report on this. How these relationships play out will have a major bearing on the future of the world in the coming period. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. We just heard from Keith Bennett, China scholar and co-editor of the Friends of Socialist China website. Next up is Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition and the International Action Center.
Thank you to the International Manifesto for this opportunity and this incredible panel. It's what we need in the period ahead. Greater collaboration, exchange, and determined solidarity. First, I want to salute the ceasefire deal today. After 15 months of U.S.-funded vicious destruction by the Israeli occupation forces of every block and neighborhood in Gaza, including every hospital, school, torching tent cities, today is a ceasefire, the beginning of a prisoner exchange agreement that leaves the Palestinian resistance undefeated. The heroic people of Palestine have forced the U.S.-backed Zionist regime to officially deal with Hamas and the resistance organizations who have remained intact. In resistance and guerrilla warfare, to survive as an organization is to live to fight another day. We salute the enormous political, organizational, and military accomplishment paid at a high price. Israel and U.S. imperialism are hated globally on a scale not seen before. Tens of thousands of Zionist settlers have left Israel, where thousands of businesses have closed. Zionism has failed to achieve its aims, and the resistance has survived. This latest ceasefire, no matter how short-term or long-term, reflects that Israel and its imperialist backers are not invincible. The complete inability of Israel in more than 15 months of bombing, backed by the U.S. and the other imperialist powers, to defeat the Palestinian liberation struggle and the revolutionary unity of the axis of resistance confirms the limits of U.S. power. This ceasefire confirms that resistance, unity, and political morale are stronger than the most brutal, advanced, high-tech weapons. Now, let's talk about the Trump presidency and the prospects for peace in 2025. You can't put the two together. There is no prospect of peace. Trump is not offering peace. The MAGA slogan, "Make America Great Again," is a war cry. MAGA is also an out-of-date wish list. It confirms just how out of touch the U.S. ruling as class establishment is with the world today. U.S. hegemony is gone, but U.S. imperialists in their arrogance can't see the facts on the ground. Slogans or threats won't change the downward spiral of U.S. imperialism. Wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, total support of the Zionists in Palestine, NATO war in Ukraine, sanctions on 40 countries, a third of the world population, threats on Korea and Iran, efforts to encircle China, they're all massively destructive, fabulously expensive. It includes the use of mercenary armies, proxy forces, thousands of U.S.-funded NGOs. But two decades of nonstop wars have failed to turn the U.S. global position around. U.S. strategy continues, It's to create chaos and to disrupt development everywhere. Now, this is not the world situation that Trump faced when he was elected president in 2016, a mere 8 years ago. The world is changing fast. Whether Republican or Democratic Party are in office, the U.S. empire today has nothing to offer the world except more threats, sanctions, and wars. And that is no longer sufficient to maintain its dominance. The effort to threaten China by dismembering Russia totally failed, and it actually reinforced the trade and security integration of Russia and China. Now, just today, Russia and Iran signed a strategic partnership accord involving defense and economic exchange at a whole new level. There's rapidly developing alliances of countries of the global South, and it can no longer be ignored. While Trump and his whole crew of right-wing racist planners announced their plans to take everything backward, the whole world is consciously moving forward. Now, we don't know what aggressive plans Trump will announce today, tomorrow, and in the days ahead. The Trump announcement that the U.S. must take over Greenland, make Canada the 51st state, and retake the Panama Canal is directed at attempting total control of this hemisphere. It's an assertion, and it's part of a wild attempt to isolate China, to control the shipping lanes of the Arctic and the Panama Canal, the global navigation routes, and it will arouse a firestorm in this hemisphere. There's now a whole series of trade alliances, new forms of exchange, and a confident new spirit that confront the tired old MAGA slogan. China's Belt and Road Initiative, involving 150 countries, it's the most ambitious infrastructure project ever conceived. Among the world's emerging economies, new payments and trade mechanisms to bypass U.S.-dominated structures and those horrific sanctions on a third of the world are developing. More than 30 countries have applied to join BRICS. There's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Trump and the new administration is focusing on China, on China, on China. Why? China is the world's largest exporter of goods, the largest producer of real goods, and this is a threat to U.S. economic dominance. The scale of China's exports of $1.6 trillion to the countries of the global South and the BRICS countries is now four times that of China's annual exports to the U.S. So what China offers is not just a powerful economy and new development plans. Because China's socialist base isn't driven to maximize profit for its private shareholders in every possible transaction, the government is able to introduce a wholly different approach to development. This gives rise to a very different kind of international relations. Genuine collaboration is possible, and this is a radical break from centuries of horrific imperialist looting in Africa, Asia, throughout the global South. Globally, there is a steady determination to develop alternatives. And because U.S. imperialism is incapable of any project that's not immediately profitable for its corporate investors, it's only able to issue streams of threats, warnings, and false information against Belt and Road development projects. But even if Trump isn't first and foremost a capitalist, a racist demagogue, the whole vast apparatus of 800 military bases globally, the huge, highly profitable military industry, the invasive national security apparatus, that's who operates and sets policy, regardless of who's in office, Republican or Democrat, Biden or Trump. The interlocking military-industrial complex of banking, military industries, huge lobbying corporations, that determines U.S. policy. Now, the Trump administration is unapologetic. Trump is a billionaire capitalist and proud of it. He can only survive, though, by providing new sources of profit to the corporate elite. And that means looting Social Security, turning it over to Wall Street, or drastic cuts in social services, every conceivable service, or investing U.S. funds in cryptocurrencies. It's all economic growth and profit based on wild speculation. There's endless schemes to loot the working class in the United States today, but how to divide the working class to accomplish it? That is what Trump is proposing. Blame migrants, not the corporate rulers. Promise mass deportations. Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, intends to expel some 13 million undocumented workers, rounding them up, putting them in camps. These migrant workers keep essential industries, construction, agriculture, hospitality, home care, running. And it's a plan to cause massive misery and disrupt society. Blame trans people. Divide, divide, attack the most vulnerable. But the problem remains that imperialism can create horrific ruin, millions of refugees, but it cannot consolidate its control. U.S. imperialism is totally overextended. So in closing, in the period ahead, we need to escalate our solidarity with Palestine, with Syria, where there's such a setback, with Lebanon, with Iran, and with China, and with the sanctioned countries of Africa and the Americas. There's a new day, and the old order is collapsing. U.S. imperialism is in decline and decay. There are numerous emerging alliances. There's commodity trading platforms along with cross-border payment instruments. There's new political and economic structures. This cooperation gives hope for the future. The people of the whole world are demanding an end to all the restrictive, prohibitive measures. With renewed determination, let's strengthen our solidarity. I'll end with a salute to the heroic people of Venezuela, a salute to the elections in Venezuela, a salute to the new Federation of the Sahel in Africa, and to Palestine and continued resistance. Cooperation and development among all the people of the world is the only way forward.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent, and we just heard from Sarah Flounders of the United National Anti-War Coalition and the International Action Center. This episode was audio from a webinar titled Trump's Presidency and the Prospects for Peace. The webinar took place on January 19, 2025, and was co-sponsored by the International Manifesto Group, Critical Theory Workshop, the International Action Center, the Palestine Chronicle, and Friends of Socialist China. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.